So I haven't actually got a title, as you could imagine, but we'll try to weave in some of the suggestions for the evening talk, and hopefully as much as possible make it appropriate and relevant to the meditation and to the depths of one's practice. Not being here, of course, I haven't had the opportunity to know and listen to what the other teachers have been saying through the days, so there may be a little bit of overlapping here. initially attending to our inner life and experience, we get exposed initially perhaps to varying degrees of movement. And we ask ourselves, what's going on inside of us? What's happening in our inner life? And we might go to the content, we might enter into a description of what's taking place, as can be quite appropriate to do. Or we can just simplify things in a rather useful and skillful way and say, there's movement going on. My mind moves. It keeps taking different shapes, different forms, different kinds of states of mind arise. Some of them pleasant, some of them decidedly unpleasant, and a fair spectrum of them somewhere in between. So we look at our inner life, our psychological climate, as much as with the outer climate, and we see this variations of movement which is going on. And according to the strength of movement, it often invites, of course, comparing, judging, and the fixations of viewpoints. So in other words, there's our mind, states of mind are arising during the day. Maybe some strength to some of them. And out of the impact comes the viewpoint. We describe what's going on inside of our mind. And the viewpoint can be very positive and enthusiastic, built up on what we experience. Or the viewpoint arising can be negative, harsh, and judgmental. And we have this rather peculiar capacity to actually believe in rather decisively what the view is about the mind. Our approval and our disapproval, our being for the state of mind and being against the state of mind. It's as though we have the idea that there is a kind of independent witness who looks at the states of mind, who views the states of mind in particular ways, decides what it is, and in all of that decision we form the conclusion, this is who we are. This is the kind of person that we are. So it's not just these movements of states of mind that matter to us, but equally matters, what is the interpretation of it? What's the view of it? What's the residue of opinion that's left even after the state of mind is gone? And sometimes in the view opinion that's left at the end of it, we enter into the kind of absolute and eternal language. I always, I never, I can't. every time, nothing ever, and then we add something onto it, and we become quite convinced that the viewpoint is true, factual, a real statement of who we are. What a way to live. It's a disastrous way of living. Because we keep forgetting again and again that the intensity of the viewpoint is related to the intensity of the experience that came before it. It's nothing independent, separate, no unique, clear, special, unadulterated, objective witness or observer to what's going on. Not possible. So in the movement of our mind, in our sitting, walking and the day, we're not only concerned with the movement of the mind, but equally with how much we believe in the view that arises around it. Because there the self takes birth. States of mind, movements of mind, and the view, what we call about ourself. Can we accommodate and embrace and acknowledge the movement and the view which comes about the movement? Just as movement, just as state of mind which is arising and passing as it does. Sometimes, as somebody was asking about preferences, little bit here with the language, and it takes sometimes a little while to get familiar with kind of language that's used. So, as Christina was speaking yesterday evening about the area and the field of craving, desire, wanting, and all that sense of unfulfillment or inadequacy that can go with it, then there are some of the basic needs that we have in life: food, clothing, shelter, medicine, contact, etc. When in life the basic need becomes pressure, becomes wanting, becomes I have, I must have, when that has got a grip on us, we call it suffering, we call it unhappiness, we call it unsatisfactoriness. The mind is caught in a grip. And awareness and practice and here and now is developing the capacity in life so that we can see the movement of mind and acknowledge its movement. Can the movement be without feeling to be in the grip of? Can our practice, can we bring sufficient awareness that mind can move and not have or not be associated with it in such a way I feel I'm in the grip of? And if we were to take an experience or one or two experiences out of the day or out of the time here, we might just turn our attention back and ask ourselves, what experience that was going on for me, which was charged with wanting, which was decisively unsatisfactory, and therefore I knew I was in the grip of? And it might be, for some of you, that there are one or two experiences over the days here that one knows that was caught up, one was caught up and in the grip of. and one can turn one's attention as well and equally, what kind of experiences arise in which there was movement and interest and expression, and one knows that one was not in the grip of? One gives the intimation of freedom, and the other is the intimation of hell. Can we know ourselves just well enough, not being too ambitious, just well enough to take real interest to when we are in the grip of, no matter what it is, and when we are not? And if we were just to keep that in mind, in interest, in our attention, in our life, freedom would stand out, the ending of the grip would be over, and all the teachings of the Dharma would be abundantly clear, just through understanding clearly, clearly one single essential point for human liberation: being with without being in the grip of, or tragically being with and being in the grip of. Sometimes we take some interest in what we call preferences, and for the most part with preferences, the initial reflection or consideration would be, what I choose in life, a thoughtful person would ask, is it going to cause suffering for oneself or others? And the inner and immediate response might be to that one, no, it isn't. So the preference which one has is small change of life, really. One goes to one's cupboard at home, one's so blessed, and looks in and says, well, I'll choose to wear this or this. It's a preference. And not that you've got many of these preferences on a retreat here, given that most of you come with a suitcase and a backpack or whatever. But there's some preference there. But what, when something's got a grip on us, the preference is charged with something, it's infected with something, and the mind is caught up in the I must have syndrome. While you've been here, you lucky people, there have been millions in what some call consumer paradise this week, others would call consumer nightmare. And so while you're sitting here and looking at your preferences, others are not living like this elsewhere. And I had the questionable privilege of standing in a shop, those of you who live in this country will know it, called Next. And everything was half price, and my teenage daughter was zooming around with the rest of humanity. There were queues, I had to queue for the privilege of joining the nightmare. And what was interesting, just standing there witnessing all of this, was the highs and the lows that were going on in people's experiences. When somebody found that pair of jeans that fitted, and when somebody didn't. heaven and hell before one's eyes based on 2 centimeters. And so there can be this inner movement. There's preferences there. It's got some charge to it. Highs and lows, swings and roundabouts, dependent on the movement of mind of getting what I want. Just as that can come into the consumer culture, all the pleasures and pains that might go along with it. But precisely the same mindset can arise in here. One enters into the realms of silence and stillnesses and here and now. And in the movement that takes place there, there's preferences going on as well. Most meditators prefer comfort to discomfort, joy to frustration, clarity to confusion, or whatever. It's a preference. And it's a preference which arises in the mind towards natural and human enough. But what would it be to enter into a situation with a view which is ruthless, which says, I sit and no preference. I walk, no preference. I eat, no preference. I stand, no preference. I listen, no preference. None whatsoever. What would it be to enter into a silence, into a stillness, and to be ruthlessly determined to be without a preference? Light, dark, young, old, cold, warm, all those dances of duality that you and I are all too familiar with. And then instead of looking for ways for the self to feel better through succeeding its preferences, one takes what might be a relatively unusual position. No preference. If it's uncomfortable in here for 45 minutes, period, it's that. If the breakfast, lunch, tea and whatever is such that it couldn't be better, so what? No preference. So the movement of the mind and the movement of the self towards preference is truly a minor detail of life. Then where would it leave us? Sometimes people hear the Dharma pointing towards beyond preference and think, oh, this is impossible. I can't live like this. I come here, I prefer to listen to a Dharma talk than a sermon on Virgin Railways or whatever. Whole life is full of these preferences arising and passing, arising and passing. This life is nothing but preferences. Might have some greed and selfishness and ego and irritability in some of them, and I might do it with greater equanimity and kindness and love with others of them. Whole life seems to be one movement back and forward between preferences, along which we agree with some of those which we have between us, and we disagree with others, and we'll try and get on as best we can. That's life. Ooh, risky view of existence. terribly dependent on the preferences of others and one's own preferences, and the miracle that they sometimes coincide sweetly. Oh, terrible risky way of living. So sometimes one finds oneself in a kind of understandable inner rebellion. Can't live without preferences. Please be watchful of the viewpoint. What would it be to be without preference? To get a sense of it. Sometimes when we stop and we're still in our stopping, we have a genuine acknowledgement and appreciation for wanting for nothing. Christina was speaking on these themes yesterday evening. And in that wanting for nothing, we might speak of the importance and the sense of nothing. Not in a negative or painful or nihilistic way whatsoever, but just a sense in one's stillness, in one's sitting, in one's standing, in one's walking, in one's whatever, of nothing whatsoever to be asked of from this world. Nothing. Nothing whatsoever. Nothing from life. And if we're willing, as the old text, as was quoted a little earlier, if we're willing just to be with this perception of asking for nothing from this world whatsoever, perhaps it will generate out of us, perhaps, a different kind of receptivity, which has got nothing to do with preferences. Nothing to do with what the self wants. Can you follow? We go through our day, and our merely mind, everyday mind, says, oh, I'd prefer to have a calm, clear day. I'd prefer if that person sitting next to me would stop picking their nose. I'd prefer if that person at the meal table would try to reduce it from 3 kilos a plate to 2 kilos. Or whatever the current thought's going. And one's genuinely committed to the practice of no preference. Quite firm and clear through the rhythm and flow of the day. In that, as much as we can, it generates a certain kind of receptivity, which the self and its preferences doesn't know what it is. The self and its preferences only knows what I see and hear, smell and taste, what I think about, what I remember, what I plan, what I will do. All it knows is trivial stuff. Minor little entertainments of life. So in being still, without preference, and the self may be a little bit bemused, and all it can do is hang in, be steady, and see what might touch us, which is not in this world of preferences. And the intensification of preferences we call desire, the intensification of desire we call craving, and the whole tragic grip that human beings can so easily we find ourselves in. So we go from gross to subtle. Craving, softening of it to desire, softening of it to wanting, softening of it to certain needs, basic needs, softening of it again to preferences, etc. Till we say, hey, I don't have to live just as though that's what existence is. And I'm prepared to be rather ruthless. No preference for anything. Even when I'm making the preferences. Extra spoon of sugar, extra 10 minutes in bed, extra bit of meditation time, or whatever it might be. Yes, yes, yes. Can acknowledge all of that. But it's not what essentially, fundamentally, primarily matters. Because the self and preferences is too shallow. Sometimes we might say, well, gosh, without my preferences, I'm a nobody. It's my preferences that make my conception of who I am. And when other people look at me, whoever the me is, they say, who's this person? And then we give a description of the person, and to some degree our description will give some acknowledgement of what they've chosen to do with their life. And some of the description wasn't their preferences. Place of birth, people that we were, family that we were born to, name that we got, except for the most part. So what does it mean? What is this receptivity? In which the self and craving, self and desire, self and need, self and preferences is acknowledged but not reinforced. What does it mean then to let all of that take secondary place and to go, as it were, to what we don't know? Just as I mentioned to you when I spoke to you in the opening, during the opening talk, I mentioned that I'd been to, was going to my funeral of my great aunt, and at the Anglican minister gave the funeral service. And he had been to visit my mother to get some, as is customary, some general details about my aunt, and then spoke rather lovingly and warmly about her during the funeral service. And another's telling me that generations ago in this country, or in parts of rural parts of the country, when somebody died in the street, not only were the curtains of the home pulled and closed, but everybody did it in the street to acknowledge a death of somebody in the street. And when the hearse came to collect to the home and the funeral went in the vehicle, people had stood outside their door to attention as a sign of last respect. And when we left this suburban street, Norbrecht in the north of England, the funeral director got out of the car with the coffin in and walked down the street in front of the car. And so the car was driving very slowly with my mother and my uncle and my sister, my daughter and myself. And just went, traveled slowly down the street. Some of you will know this from your own families and friends. And then maybe you turned the corner, he got in the car, and we continued with the journey. And what struck me in all of this, and may also be familiar to yourself, how, when you've known someone, known them well, many conversations, many meetings, letters, phone calls, etc., and the person's gone out of the life, sometimes it takes that to give us a very clear reminder of our own transience in this world. And the closer that somebody is to us, very close friend, loved one, family member, or someone who's come close to numerous people, the situation of Princess Diana, of course, can touch something quite deep inside of oneself that touches something of the heart quite unexpected. It can bring something else out of us which is significant. There's a sense of receptivity to something. I watched a documentary on, there's been many on Princess Diana, and the film cameramen were talking to people around Westminster and Hyde Park and Kensington Palace and Buckingham Palace, etc., etc. And one of the common voices that were being said, and one hears it situations here as well, of people saying, I don't want to leave, there's something which is important, which I can't quite understand or make sense of, but I know it's absolutely right to be here, to be in this moment, to be in this situation. And the mind, with its various movements that go on, can't collate it, can't organize it, can't pick it up. But something else is going on, somewhere else in the being, which is responding and receptive to. And teachings point in that direction again and again. And it's as though we're being asked, and we are asking of ourselves, to keep putting ourselves into a situation, into an environment, into a presence, into a here and now, which somehow draws out something out of our being. And that's what the meditation hall is intended to do. That's what the walking meditation is intended to do. That's what being here and now is intended to do. That's what the silence is intended to do. That the teachings and the instructions and everything is to give access to something which one knows is valid, and it's not just produced of the mind. Rather wonderful thing in the meditations. Strange thing with meditation, both in the sitting and in the walking. Sometimes we're sitting in the stillness, and X number of minutes pass by, and then we find ourselves moving. It's hardly world-shattering stuff, but one has just found oneself moving. It might be scratching, it might be stretching the legs, or looking around, or the inevitable checking out how much longer to go, or whatever. And nobody is enforcing anything on us. But it seems like sometimes in the movement, in the restlessness, in the fidget, in the scratch, in the fiddling with the posture or whatever, sometimes it seems like we missed an opportunity. Sometimes there's feeling like I needn't have done that, or it was too much, or no need to have moved. We're doing the walking meditation. And then there comes the idea to take one more painful look in the mirror or something. Or have a cup of tea or whatever. And one's walked off into space. And why did I do that? Just walking meditation, 10 or 15 minutes, and then I'm off on a tangent. What is it about the element of stillness and of presence in which even the smallest little movement can genuinely feel to disturb the world of 10,000 things? What is it that movement and doing seems to obscure and hide? What is it that preferences, shall I ashantai, shall I ashantai, seem to be so trite that something about stillness will tell us more than the movement? What is it telling us? What is it to be informed through that rather than through knowledge? Rather than through activity? Rather than through preferences? So sometimes a minute of impeccable stillness in a sitting can be far more revealing than hours of mediocre sitting. To let the silence fill us. May all beings go deep. May all beings see deeply into things. May all beings discover that joy which is truly liberating. So let's have a couple of silent minutes together, shall we please?